Good afternoon and welcome to Who's in the Kitchen. You're listening to community radio coming from Viroqua, Wisconsin in the Driftless area, 91.9 FM and streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org, where you can listen to this show and previous shows by going to our archives at our website. And this show's going to be about eggs. Seems like we need to talk about eggs. And I've got a very experienced person who's going to be on my show, and that's Harriet Bihar. She's been on my show before. She's my expert in organic agriculture, I guess you would say. So welcome, Harriet.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Okay. So, eggs are really expensive, and I thought, well, let's talk about eggs. Let's talk about, you know, why. I think maybe people are kind of getting the idea of why eggs are expensive, but some of them are exorbitantly expensive, and they probably don't need to be. So we're going to go all over the map on eggs, but both Harriet and I raise chickens. I have a very small flock. She has about 40, but and we have, you know, customers that buy our eggs, and so we're the local small egg producers, and we can talk about the big egg producers. But I noticed as I was doing a little research for this show, there are many websites and chat rooms and everything about chickens. People love chickens, and they love talking with other people about chickens and all that's involved in raising chickens. And, you know, you just go to the store and buy eggs, and you just don't really realize, you know, what has to go into them. You have to have a healthy flock. And, you know, and then you have to, what are you feeding them? And are they getting outside? And are they getting what they need? And so we might even talk just a little bit about what, you know, what a healthy chicken needs to be healthy. And it's a whole agricultural endeavor, because you have to have housing and feed and so forth. So maybe just a couple of minutes talking about what a chicken really would like to have to make eggs, and what happens also, you know, when there is egg production, what their patterns are and so forth.
Okay, well, I just want to say too that, you know, your little chat rooms, all your little chicken chat rooms, there's a reason that people like having backyard flocks. And it kind of flies in the face of industrial agriculture, mm-hmm. in that, you know, chickens do have personalities, and they can be very pleasurable birds to be around. But in the industrial size of operations, they're just kind of treated like machines and not even like sentient beings at all. Mm. And they definitely are. I'm sure you feel that way. I mean, we have, you know, some chickens like to kind of come over and like rub up against you, and others a little more skitterish. And there's one thing about chickens that I really, really love. And when they're happy, they make kind of a cooing noise. Mm-hmm. And it is very calming for us humans to hear that cooing noise. Mm-hmm. So we have this connection, like we'll do things to help them be satisfied and happy, mm-hmm. and then they reward us with that wonderful soft cooing sound. But then it's very sad when you go into a very large chicken house, especially when the birds do not get to go outside. And I've been in even caged houses, not organic. And, you know, all you hear is the sound they make when they are upset. This very loud, you know, kind of a scream. And of course, when one makes it, they all make it, because they're very flock-oriented. And so it's like you need to wear earplugs when you go into a confinement chicken house, because they are all extremely upset.
Yeah.
All the time.
Oh, they're just crammed together, right?
And if one's upset, they're all upset. They may not, mm-hmm. even know why they're upset, mm-hmm. but they're upset. And I know that, like with meat, you know, you don't really want to have meat with the cortisol hormones. I don't know anything about if, you know, how that goes into the eggs, but I certainly know that our customers love the eggs that we sell to them because the eggs are really, they have bright orange yolks and they just, you know, they come from healthy and happy chickens.
That's what you really want. You want a healthy animal to produce those eggs. And so what goes into the health of the animal is not just a number of, you know, ounces of this and that for feed or something like that. I mean, or the minimum of what they need. I can really tell when my chickens, I was keeping them in the chicken house this winter, and finally I just opened the door, and they are so happy, and they just run around, and they scratch, and they're just, and then they follow me everywhere, and it is really funny. People laugh. You know, I have my little 8 hens just following me, and I just, it's really fun. Yes, they do have personalities, and they do like to be outside, and even if you think, well, what's outside? There's no grass. Are there any bugs? What are they getting? I don't know, but they get to have little rocks. They need rocks to, you know,
for their gizzards. Yep.
For their gizzards.
We like to every day throw them some scratch on the ground. Give them organic wheat berries.
They like to do that.
I talked to a poultry nutritionist.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And he said not only is it good for them to get that grain, but it's good for their mental health to do the hunt and peck.
Okay.
And I thought about that. And, you know, chickens, their brains are about the size of a pea. And thinking about trying to have them have healthy mental health seemed a little funny. But it's true.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's good. I need to be reminded of those things. And that's what happens in these chat rooms. Just people talk and talk about what they've tried, what didn't work, how they keep their pens clean and their nest boxes and what their chickens like and don't like. And it's just very, very interesting. And yes, it's maybe right now people might want to think about, with the price of eggs and with bird flu seeming to be a concern, maybe they might want to consider, you know, getting some hens. And you don't have to have a rooster to have eggs. A lot of people don't even know that.
That is true.
So I always think my hens are happier if there isn't rooster in there. He kind of protects them. And he just makes them feel like they're ladies.
Well, right? they coalesce around the rooster.
Yeah. Yeah, they do.
And he kind of keeps his eye out for predators. And
so my nice, kind rooster bits of the dust. But so I think it was just, you know, an old age. Somebody gave them to me, and
see,
I don't know why he died.
Unfortunately, for most people, most of the eggs come from very large operations, including organic eggs, are larger operations. And so unless you are lucky enough to find someone locally who can sell you eggs, or you can get your 4 or 5 there in the backyard, but, I mean, that is a commitment. Somebody's going to have to come and feed your birds, and you're going to have a big enough area that's, you know, closed in because, as a good friend of mine likes to say, everybody loves chicken. I mean, possums love chicken and, you know. And
weasels and raccoons and hawks.
And dogs.
Dogs, yes. I've had dogs worry my chickens to death.
Yeah, well, and eat your chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And coyotes. And
yeah, so everybody loves chicken.
Everybody loves chicken.
So you have to have a safe, we say that we have Fort Knox there, but we have, you know, a cement floor and metal siding,
right,
and, you know, bars, and then we have buried fence down 1 foot. But I have had a raccoon dig a tunnel under the fence and massacre everybody.
Right.
So,
well, a lot of times you can just close them in at night. You know, they tend to, when it starts getting dark, they go in and they like to roost. So they like to go on, because they used to live in trees. So that's where they like to be. So, I mean, we have an electric fence around our chicken area that we can move when we move the coop around, so they always
have. And that's to keep the predators out.
And that's to keep the predators out and to keep them in,
because
otherwise they always feel like the grass is greener on the other side. And but at night, If there's snow on the ground and we can't have the electric fence on, well, then we just lock them in.
Mm-hmm.
And
although mine have been quite recalcitrant, and they, well, for one thing, they absolutely won't go in until the sun is absolutely down. It's really dark.
Oh, yeah. We call them juvenile delinquents at that point.
And then there's some who've decided to roost in the trees rather than go in at night. And they're just naughty little girls, and I don't know what to do. Sometimes we collect them, and sometimes we just say, well, learn, live and learn.
Well, if you need the tree, then leave the tree. But, I mean, we had some, and we just cut the tree down.
Oh, but they do
gave them one less place to go.
Yeah. But mine stopped laying because I actually didn't have any heat or light for a few weeks there. We didn't have power going to the coop. But so they stopped laying, and I hear that that's not bad for them. It's natural. And if you keep a light on in heat, they might not stop laying during the winter, but they might go down in production in the winter.
Yeah, a little bit. But one of the reasons why the light... it kind of changes their cycle, but also they'll be more active, and so when they're active and eating, then they lay eggs. Mm-hmm. If they're just like laying on the couch, they don't lay so many eggs. So I mean, that's part of it's mm-hmm. just keeping them active.
But I noticed as soon as, you know, we passed the winter solstice, I mean, in a week or two, they started laying again, and not all of them, but there's a few eggs every day. So they really do like the light, and they notice, you know, when the days are getting longer.
Yeah.
So that's kind of fun. I've gotten a couple of fairy eggs, and I just found out about fairy eggs on the internet today. You know what a fairy egg is?
Are those the ones without the hard shells?
Well, no, they're actually just really tiny eggs, but they don't usually have a yolk. No yolk.
No yolk. I didn't know called them fairy eggs.
They call them fairy eggs, and they are really tiny, you know. They're really cute. I save a few of them, and then they kind of dry up, and I think, well, I'll decorate these. These are really cute. But anyway.
See, but if we were going to talk about why the price of eggs are so high.
Okay.
It really goes down to consolidation in the food system. There's so many, there used to be like just egg farms everywhere and egg washing plants that would, you know, get the eggs from, you know, all the egg farms.
Oh.
And then I don't even know if there is an egg washing plant in the state of Wisconsin anymore. They're just, everything has gotten consolidated. There's really a lot of egg laying chickens in Iowa. You know, this is like all concentrated there. And a lot of that then also comes from the consolidation in the food business. So if you're a farmer and you want to sell eggs to someone, the market kind of forces you to have to sell in this vertically integrated system.
Explain that, vertically.
So vertically integrated is that the farmer actually does not even... They own the birds, but they don't really own their system of production. They build the houses, and usually there's multiple, very large. This is in a conventional world. Large chicken houses where the chickens don't go out. There isn't even natural light in there. Sometimes they have just like a red light in there so they don't peck at each other, because when they are stressed out, they tend to cannibalize each other. But we'll go there in a different later. But so the company tells you how big the chicken house is, how to build them, all the dimensions. The farmer takes on the debt for building the chicken houses. They're even heated so to keep the birds warm through the winter. Then they deliver the young pullets, which are kind of teenage chickens, to the farm. The farmer has to buy the pullets that they are given.
They don't have any choice of
They don't have any choice.
Yeah.
Then they have to buy the feed from the company, and they don't have any choice on how much, what kind of feed, you know, and how much they pay. That's the same also for the birds. They just, this is the contract. You buy from us at our price. You buy the feed at our price. You use our veterinarians at our price. And when they start to lay eggs, you just accept the price that we give you. So there's no market, you know, like, you know, any. I mean, who knows? I don't even know in the conventional world if the farmers who are vertically integrated are even seeing any of the higher price that's in the marketplace, because they're under contract. And they don't have a choice to say, wait a minute, eggs are $5 a dozen in the store. Why are you giving us 80 cents a dozen? You know, because when they were a dollar, right, or $1.50, this is the price. I mean, I didn't do any research into that, but and who knows if I'd even be able to find it out, because this is all very, insulated inside those companies.
Mm-hmm. And this is done for other farm products.
Yes,
like
hogs.
Cattle, hogs.
Yeah, not so much cattle, but hogs, where you get the piglets from them, you buy the feed from them, and they buy. And so what has happened then, those larger companies have cornered the marketplace. And so the smaller operations have less and less places to go. They won't buy from you if you're independent. They'll only buy from you if you are part of their feudal system, where they're the king and you're the peasant just growing for them.
So you mean like grocery stores? They're not going to buy, you know, you don't go in and sell them six dozen eggs.
Well, right. And also then you can't, the smaller operations that, you know, there's a time frame when they don't have any eggs, you know, when they've switched out a new flock and the young ones aren't quite laying yet, and they want to have, we're going to order 10 pallets of eggs a week, and we want 10 pallets of eggs a week, and that's what the big companies can provide. And that's what they say, well, we'll always provide this to you because we have farms all over. So if this one is in their downtime, we've got somebody over here who can always guarantee this to you. And with their efficiency of having all these farms in one place and everything going to one chicken egg washing facility and packaging, they can kind of undercut people, you know. So this is in service of the cheap food policy that we've had here in America for many years.
We have, and eggs have been really cheap. And I have often thought, you can't raise eggs anymore for 70 cents a dozen. They've been under a dollar a dozen for decades. And yet, if you're raising hens on organic feed, you know that organic feed is expensive. And so I really think, I mean, $3.50 or $4 a dozen now is really about what it costs to raise eggs. I mean, if people are expecting it to be less than that, well, I guess you're saying that, you know, when it's done commercially and in large quantities, they can reduce the price. But then, so maybe eggs can be a little bit less than that. But to the huge prices, and I paid $8 for a dozen eggs in La Crosse at just a general grocery store, and I thought, no wonder people are upset. $8 is really wild. Now, why is that? Can we explain that all because of the bird flu? And we should get into that topic.
So the answer is yes, due to bird flu, they've had to kill many, you know, 40 million or something birds, and they're still doing it. But part of that, the reason why those numbers are so huge is due to the concentration. You can have, you know, hundreds of thousands of birds on one farm.
I don't know if people realize that.
Yeah,
and
so
not,
they may not all
chickens.
Be in their say in the same house. They might have 70,000 birds.
Period.
In one house.
This will record your hands on the table.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So, and then they could have five houses. And those houses are, you know, maybe 50 feet away from each other. And they have fans, you know, and so they're getting, you know, the air from the other houses. And if these are operations, again, where the birds never go outside. And when, and there is some science that shows that when chickens are on dirt, they, it helps boost their immune systems.
Now, how are the, how do they handle the manure? Are the chickens on wire? How do they handle the manure?
Yes,
the
many times, yes.
Okay.
They don't even have a chance to scratch. So they are on wire about 3 feet off the ground, and then there's nipple waterers where they learn how to kind of hit a nipple and the water comes out. There's troughs that are moving that, that they hear the electric motor go on, and here comes the feed, and they all get excited, and and the feed comes through the house like 3 times a day. And then they have what are called rolling nests, so they can go in the nest, and then it's kind of on an angle, and the egg gently rolls down to a conveyor belt and out of the house. So human hands never touch. And the only time that the operator really goes in there is if some of the mechanicals break.
Or there's death.
Or there's death, yes. They have to keep track, you know, go in there. But they don't usually even go in every day to look for dead chickens. I mean, imagine trying to find a dead chicken in 70,000 chickens. So they will kind of, you know, make a plan like once a week.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the other birds, they're omnivores, and they do cannibalize each other. So if there's a dead chicken and it died of bird flu, the other birds will be eating on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just gone. Mm-hmm. But of course, they don't have very good immune systems. And so when there's an outbreak, they have to kill them all. And not only do they kill them all, they'll like say, we got to kill all the birds in the whole county.
Who decides that? Is that
Usually the State Department of Ag?
Okay.
Talk about.
Yeah, that's pretty bad news. And who takes that loss?
The farmer.
Oh my gosh.
I'm not sure if they can get insurance for that or not. I doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then they usually. They gas them.
They'd have to bury them or something.
Dig a big pit.
Because, you can't just let dead chickens lie. No, you can't.
No, it's it's gruesome.
Mm-hmm. And then apparently wild birds can pick up bird flu.
Yes, and they're the ones who spread it somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we are actually having issues with more than one strain of bird flu, you know, the one that affects the cattle and then the people, and it's constantly mutating. So I hate to say this, but stay tuned.
Yes.
You know, this is not like, we'll get over this and then it'll be gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you really would want those informational agencies to be free to let us know what's happening.
Yeah.
But I'm talking with Harriet Bihar. We're talking about eggs and the price of eggs and how chickens are raised. And you're listening to Who's in the Kitchen on WDRT 91.9 FM Community Radio from the Driftless area, southwestern Wisconsin. And you can also listen to this show if you'd like to again. It'll be on the archives next week. Plus a lot of other shows about food and farming on Who's in the Kitchen. So
I want to say, too, that there has been some talk about trying to develop a vaccine, because actually poultry can get vaccines. They usually put them in an aerosol form, and then they can put it in the water. And so there are certain diseases that affect chickens that can, coccidiosis, and there's some ones that kind of affect their motor system that they can get vaccinated. So there has been, of course, now we'll see, vaccines for humans anyway have been coming under some scrutiny. So not sure if there'll be any money put towards trying to deal with this through a vaccination program or not.
Right. And so also I was just making sure the flu virus, it's a virus. It's not a bacterial infection. So you have to treat it as a virus, which is maybe not so easy. I mean, antibiotics will not work on it. And so then you are looking for other ways. One would be a vaccine. And I guess keeping a healthy environment for your birds, and this is not how the commercial setups are.
And this is, again, to go back to the consolidation. I don't know if people remembered a couple of years ago with the baby formula, and actually even more recently in North Carolina, that the saline solutions that the hospitals used for IV fluids, something like 70% of it came from one factory in the entire United States. And then when that factory went down, duh. And think, I mean, it was very, it was a big crisis for the baby formula, because there were some people who, you know, they had to have this certain kind of formula because their babies were allergic to whatever and could not be found. And one facility in the entire United States. And do you think that they have now changed that and had? No. They just went right back to the one factory making the baby formula. You would think that to truly have homeland security, that we would be looking at more regional production.
Of everything. We ran into this problem with the slaughtering of animals during the COVID situation, and a lot of animals were just, livestock were just gassed and buried. They weren't even turned into meat.
Well, I just wanted to say, too, that there is an organization that fights consolidation, and it's a coalition. It's called the Campaign for Family Farmers and the Environment. And the executive director is a woman I've known for many years, Patty Lovera. She used to be with the Food and Water Watch, and she's moved over to work with this coalition. Their website is super easy to remember, fightfactoryfarms.org. Mm-hmm. And the organizations in the group are Food and Water Watch, Missouri Rural Crisis Center, Iowa Citizens for Community Involvement, Dakota Rural Action, Land Stewardship Project out of Minnesota, and the Institute for Agricultural and Trade Policy. So these are six organizations that then are part of the coalition that has someone in Washington, D.C. watching the legislative movement and advocating for less laws that actually promote. See, we have a lot of laws that promote this consolidation and work against the smaller family-type farm.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just feel like you're, you know, what's one voice going to do? I mean, and who are you talking to? And I know that you have actually been on the Agricultural Advisory Committee to the USDA.
That was for organic,
yes. Organic. And it is, I mean, from here to Washington and then all the bureaucracy and all the little committees, and you just wonder can change ever take place? Did you feel hopeful in some ways?
I did, and I'll give you an organic, because that's where I work, example. So recently, we have had issues that the rules for organic poultry were not very clear. And there were kind of factory farms, concentrated animal feeding operations that just all they did was feed the chickens organic feed, but they didn't let them outside. They said, oh, we'll open the window. That's the same thing as being outside, or we'll let them out on a porch. And there's like enough room for like less of, 1% of the birds to be out on the porch.
All kinds of loopholes.
Yes, all kinds of loopholes. But most recently, there was a new rule. It actually was put in place by the Obama administration, but at the very end of their tenure, the 8 years. So when Trump came in, they're allowed to what's called vacate a rule that had been put in place within like 3 months of them coming into office. And so they vacated it. And so now, then when Biden came in, it came back. So finally it came back. And quite a few of us worked together, and they wanted to have, you know, there was always a thought that organic chickens should go outside. And so they were putting that in there. But we said, not only do they need to go outside, but they need to be on living vegetation. And I mean, I was in those rooms, and I wanted 75%, but we got 50. So part of the new rule now is chickens have to be outside. There can't be more than so many, you know, there's so many square feet per bird, so they have to be a fairly large size. And however the farmer can arrange it by rotating or by irrigating or whatever they do, those birds have to be on 50% vegetative. So they're out there, grass, and that is living soil, and that's where they get the bugs. And and it's much easier for them to scratch, right, on living soil than it is for them to scratch on hard pan, dead soil, right? Mm-hmm. So they're not going to get anything from that dirt, mm-hmm. but if they can scratch, and especially if you move them around, then that allows the vegetation to recover. And that's what we do mm-hmm. on our farm. We also give them a very large area that there's like no way that they can denude everything.
Well, that is a problem for people who raise chickens. I mean, they will just, they'll turn the grass into hard pan if they're on it every day. And then it's just, you know, you could hardly get a seed to grow there.
Depending how big an area you mm-hmm. give them.
So you do need a pretty large area. And that's why we love to have free range. Although free range chickens on somebody's yard, they cause a lot of problems.
Unless you've got a really big fence.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's challenges to these.
Right. And so through that, so that's the final rule for organic poultry, is that they have to be on 50% mm-hmm. vegetative. That's the law.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if people really realize how strict the organic regulations are for everything, but you've been an organic certifier. Inspector certifier. And I have helped people fill out those papers myself and seen what they have to go through. I mean, it's pages and pages and pages. And people think, oh, you just put on the name organic and then you could get more for it. And I'm sorry, no. There's a lot of steps that farmers have to go through.
Yes. And really, the reason the way the rules are written is really based a lot in science. It has to do with lessening the stress of the animal. You'll have healthier, and that is a known scientific fact, that the animals will be healthier if they are not stressed. And they don't get stressed when they get to express their natural behavior, mm-hmm. which means scratching in the soil, being out in the sun and the wind, being able to flap their wings, you know, all of these things that they cannot do when they're, you know, less than a half a square foot in a concentrated building. And they're around all these other animals. I think I've read somewhere, too, that chickens can really only recognize about 300-400 other birds. And so, like, when they're in those houses, they don't really even move around. They just stay in an area with, you know, their little community. But still, they can't recognize, you know, it's very loud in there. It's very dusty in there. It's got a lot of ammonia. I mean, it's not a healthy environment. So when a pathogen like bird flu comes through, it is so easy to wipe these birds out. And so then, because there are less birds, we live in a world of supply and demand as far as pricing. And so with less eggs available, the reason why they're so high in the grocery store is to discourage people from buying them, so that there will still be some eggs on the shelf. Because if they were still at $1 a dozen, they're wouldn't be any eggs.
I know, and people have been saying they've been going to the grocery store and there are no eggs. You have to get there at 7 in the morning or there won't be eggs later on and that kind of thing. It does it seem like there's an unusually, I mean, is it all overblown? Should we just let the birds die of this fever or of this virus? Is it overreaction to go in and kill whole huge flocks, or is that just really absolutely necessary?
From what I have read, it seems like it is necessary because it's so highly infectious, and it's the kind of flu, I mean, similar to COVID, that keeps mutating. And so you don't want to give it the chance to continually mutate because that you just really would never get ahead of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it's mutated enough to now affect dairy cattle.
How does that work?
Well, it mutated. It mutated and affecting humans. So the original bird flu did not affect humans, but it's mutated now. Mm-hmm. So, to me, the answer is
prevention
and the not having so many birds in one place, not having that concentration. But can we build the infrastructure where there's a thriving egg producing farm economy, mm-hmm, in all these different regions of the country, mm-hmm, instead of all the eggs coming out of Iowa?
Well, is that putting all your eggs in one basket?
It is. And we know that does not work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, mm-hmm, I don't know that this federal administration would be open to discussion of we need for, to me, Homeland Security is having a safe and abundant food supply. And if they don't want to rely on Mexico or Canada or China for our food, then we need to look at a way to produce food here in the United States that's more resilient and that can avoid the problems rather than encourage the problems.
Mm.
So, you know, having less, but then you'd have to have... don't want to have to haul all these eggs, you know, across state lines. You know, if they're have somebody in Michigan shouldn't have to drive the eggs somewhere to get washed and packaged, like, mm-hmm, Iowa.
So some questions people have asked on the internet, and I looked at that. Can you get bird flu from eating an egg?
I do not believe so. I know that you can't get it from, there's some concern that in the milk of cows, but most of the milk is pasteurized. But if you had a sick cow on your own farm or whatever that was diagnosed with bird flu, you wouldn't want to drink that milk.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. It seems to be pretty much airborne. And so that can be, it can be in their manure, it can be in their feathers, it can be in their bedding, it can be in the air. And people know when you go into any kind of chicken house, it's dusty, really should wear a mask if you're cleaning a chicken house.
Well, as a chicken owner,
mm-hmm,
I mean, wouldn't you pretty much say a sick chicken is a dead chicken? They don't have a lot of resiliency.
No, they don't. No, if they're looking sick, they usually pass away. Yeah, yeah, right. And so they are warning, you know, say if you have a small flock, not in a commercial chicken farm, but, you know, if you've got any illness and everything, you should be wearing gloves, you should be wearing a mask, you should be careful in handling all that stuff that's in that chicken house. I mean... chickens in a small flock can get bird flu too. I don't know. I mean, if you had more than one bird pass away, you'd begin to suspect you've got something infectious.
Right, and also being aware, a lot of the bird flu here is passed by waterfowl. So if you have a bunch of geese, you know, like you have a low spot in your field, you know, 100 feet from where your chicken coop is, and there's a bunch of, you know, Canadian geese there. I mean, you might be a little bit more susceptible to it.
Plus, just wild birds, just flying around, just birds. They can carry that from one state to another. I mean, you can't control where birds fly.
No.
And they can pick it up. And so there is a possibility of spreading it to small flocks, but there's just way less chance that your little flock is going to have bird flu.
Well, but also imagine if there was so many more flocks around and they were smaller, it wouldn't have as much of an effect on the supply as when all of it is concentrated in one area.
Mm-hmm.
I don't consider myself a genius, but that just seems like common sense.
Well, this is one reason I kind of started a farm show, which airs the last Saturday of every month, because I really feel that we need to know where our food is coming from and all the challenges, all the work that goes into raising our food. And we might think that the farmers are all people like you and me, and they just have a little small farm, and, you know. But farming has really gotten very, very commercialized and very concentrated in all the different areas of food, right? Which I mean, even crops, if they're all one crop, they're susceptible to disease.
And that's the other thing, too, is when it's all chickens over here and all hogs over here, it used to be much more diverse, not just on a farm, which it was much more diverse, but in a region. That there would be, you know, they grow apples, and then these people grow corn, and then somebody else has hogs, and somebody else has chickens, and so there's that diversity in the region to then serve a diverse food supply for that region.
Mm-hmm.
But now when we get, you know, I mean, it even drives me a little crazy that you go in a regular grocery store in August, and the broccoli's from California. I mean, come
Everybody
on.
Everybody can grow broccoli.
Well, here, you know, but again, there's the consolidation, and it's like, we can give you broccoli year-round because you don't know where we're getting it from. We're getting it, you know, we're getting it from Mexico in the winter. We're getting it from California in the fall. You know, there's...
So that's why there was a movement to eat seasonally, to really realize, I mean, asparagus doesn't grow here. You know, more probably 10 months out of the year. And so, but why do we have to have asparagus? Just change your diet along with the seasons.
Or,
and what's
or freeze
growing.
Some. Hmm? Or freeze some.
Or freeze it. Right.
I think we can slowly make a difference. I'll give you another win. For about 10 years, the Center for Food Safety, a wonderful organization, fought the release of genetically engineered salmon into our food supply, and they won. It took
they
10
did.
Years, yes.
Wow.
So they cannot raise in, you know, in their whatever net pens. The genetically has not been approved for release and use, you know, and growing for a whole variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. But the Center for Food Safety won that. It took 10 years, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does need people.
Yeah, I mean, you probably heard about it and then wondered whatever happened.
I didn't know whatever happened. Well, I was thinking, going back to eggs, I was thinking, okay, you say, well, there's just like, it's all concentrated in just a few companies that, you know, control the egg production and so forth. So has there been movements to be able to market your eggs otherwise? And then I'm thinking, well, Organic Valley was one of those movements, right?
Yes.
They certified farms, and they bought eggs from them.
Well,
and they distributed.
It was an independent certifier, but yes, they went through the organic certification system.
So this is one way to get your eggs and support the, you know, poultry growers by buying organic eggs and buying them from, you know, these suppliers are actually getting them from farmers. I mean, farmers have to have a way of getting rid of their eggs,
right? Well, there's a different thing here in that the co-op is run by farmers. And it's a cooperative of farmers. So that model then can compete with the industrial model of corporate ownership. But they also don't do the vertical integration. They don't mandate, you know, that you buy your feed from us. And then when they set the price, this is the farmers talking about the price. Now they get input, you know, from the people who are in the marketing department saying, yeah, we know you'd like $20 a dozen, and that ain't going to happen. So they said, well, we need this. This is our cost of production. This is what we have to have. And so those go through. So the farmers have a seat at the table, which is in the industrial model, they don't. I know, you're laughing because it's like, why wouldn't the people who produce it have a chance? But this is kind of almost where everything, you know, we have Walmart and, you know, they kind of run the market. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're lucky here in Viroqua to have the Viroqua Food Co-op, which has your fellow members on the board and thinking about what's best for our community when they're deciding pricing, product mix, supply chain, all of those things.
So I'm sure there's many people who, listening, who don't know what a food co-op is or why it exists or what's the difference between a co-op and a grocery store, difference between a co-op and Whole Foods. You know what? I mean, the divisions, the separations have gotten kind of vague right now. But cooperatives were their member owned, and they can make decisions about it. And that was something.
Well, and the boards are member
buyers and sellers, right? I mean, everybody's on a co-op. Yeah. At Organic Valley, you have farmers, you have buyers. I mean, the co-op.
No, the buyers are not on the board. It's only a farmer board.
Okay.
So, but, you know, that, you know, of course, you know, when co-ops get big, I mean, you know, Land O'Lakes is a co-op, and there's other, you know,
Well, it's hard fighting.
Politics is difficult, but at least you've got a model where the people who are selling to or buy from have a say in where their money goes and what they're going to see in their store and how much money they're going to get for their product, like if you're a farmer. But, you know, there's the whole local food movement, which, again, is a ray of hope to, you know, rebuild. I mean, it's unfortunate, but we're trying to rebuild what really made America great in the beginning. We were an agrarian society, and we had farmers everywhere, and rural landscape was economically vibrant because farmers were selling to each other, and then farmers were selling, joining together and forming cooperatives, especially up here in the upper Midwest, and then selling product, you know, where they could to other markets. But now it's just less and less and less. Everything consolidated. Mm-hmm. When I first came to Wisconsin, the average size dairy farm was about 30 cows. The average size now is like 150. So what happened? 5 farms went out of business. The state of Wisconsin loses 3 or more dairy farms a day and has for like the past 10 years. We've lost thousands of dairy farms, but we haven't lost the cows. Now we have cows on 5,000, 10,000 cow dairies. That's not in Organic Valley, because Organic Valley, the requirement is those animals express their natural behavior because they are ruminant animals. To keep them healthy, they must eat living grass. Grass that is attached to the soil. I mean, in the winter, they eat hay, and they get some only feed grass. Others feed a little bit of corn. I mean, that grass milk that you get at Organic Valley, there's a certification for that, that those animals only got grass because that's what they're good at. To me, it's like a miracle. They can take grass and turn it into protein. I certainly can't do that. But that's the miracle of that ruminant system with all those, you know, beautiful probiotics and, you know, bacteria and, you know, in that, those three stomachs, four stomachs, whatever it is. That's the beauty of it. But, of course, then you have these animals that never see a blade of grass. They're kept in confinement. They never see the sun on their backs. And they're just machines. And cattle are definitely sentient beings. They definitely care about where they are. And they have emotions. And so this is where most of the milk comes from, is in America, from these confined. So, you know, so it's in hogs, it's in cattle, it's in chickens. Don't get me started on ducks. The conventional ducks live in the dark their whole lives. I don't even know why. I think because they like peck at each other. I don't even know why, but that's what I've seen on conventional duck operations, in the dark. That is not their natural behavior.
Now we could go to the health of those. Somebody said on my show one time, you need to know what your food eats.
Yes.
And I never really paid attention to that. But the miracle that you're talking about, the ruminant animals, just take any animal, and if it has the diet that it requires, its product is more healthful. And so I don't even eat non-organic. I want eggs that are on pasture-raised farms, because you can tell by looking at the yolks. You can tell. I mean, when you see a pasture-raised egg, the yolk is orange, and that means it has omega-3s. It has things that you really need. And if, well, like cattle have been, you know, moved to more of a grain diet, that doesn't even give their meat or their milk the kind of nutrition that you need. So you need cattle that are raised on grass, because that's what they're meant to eat. And then they're outside and they're in the sun. How could duck meat or eggs be healthful if they don't have any sun?
So the other difference is grass fed and grass pasture raised ruminant animals will live 4 times longer, 5 times longer than the confinement animals. But they do not produce as much product in a year. So it's pushing for production. But over time, you don't have to keep replacing them because they've been burned out. I mean, there's this, you know, feed them lots of corn, which is not what they're really built to eat. We used to have the RBGH to also push up their production. We don't really see that much anymore because it was burning out the cows.
So say what that.
So this is a recombinant hormone that, if any of the women in the audience had babies, when your milk comes in and you get engorged from having a baby, right? Finally, your milk comes in. This is the same thing with cows. That hormone kept the cow at continuous engorgement for its entire production cycle. That's not natural. They had to give them a shot every day to keep them producing at this massive volume.
But Harriet, what does that do to the people who drink the milk? This hormone is going through the cattle, through the milk, and then we're pushing milk.
Well, it would be in the cattle's milk for all the cattle who are just freshening. But see, in a dairy herd, this one freshens this week, then 4 weeks later another one freshens, and then you got two more over here, and there isn't this huge amount every day for 10 months mm-hmm. of that hormone in there from every cow in the herd.
And then that pushed people to have to compete because if you're, you know, the neighbor's cows are producing more longer than, you know, you, it's sort of like get big or get out. I mean, you follow, you just are obliged to follow the patterns that are being brought into agriculture.
I don't really even blame the farmers. This, the whole agricultural system mm-hmm. Is not really in their favor. Mm-hmm. And so they get kind of pushed to having to have these higher yields, which, you know, are eroding the soil, and mm-hmm. you know, and they can't even afford. What happened is people stopped using it because they found that they had to feed so much higher quality food that then the amount of extra milk they got didn't pay for trying to keep the animal healthy from that higher production. Mm-hmm. So they basically are not really using it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a big fight.
Yes, it was. To kind of conclude, we've gone on our rants about things, but I hope that people realize that some of the changes that and challenges to the big system that has taken over in agriculture, to understand why there have been questioning of this and why it's important to find out who is actually doing research and making alternative suggestions, and why the organic movement even had to come into place, and what it is doing. And I think it might be good to share with us again the list that you had of some of these, if you're interested and you want to know more about it or what you could do, but certainly not to actually do a call to action, which you're not supposed to do on community radio, but letting you know how you can be involved and how you could change your buying habits by seeking locally produced food, finding farmers that do sell eggs, going to the farmer's market. There's such things as CSAs, which is community-supported agriculture. And you can be a member and then then your farmer knows they have a customer.
Right.
And that they know how much to grow, how many eggs to raise, or how much, you know, how many crops. And now I notice, and I actually started participating, there are pasture-raised products that are being sold on the internet. You can join a club like a CSA, and they'll send you grass-fed meat.
And there's a lot of people, if you look at the banners list. But I would say, too, when you go in your conventional grocery store and you see a worker there, say, where do you get these eggs? Where do they come from?
Mm-hmm.
They do respond to that because most of their consumers don't ask. And so the more people that say, is there a source of regional eggs
that
you could get?
They just ask.
Just talk and just let them know that you care. I think that part of it is we've just kind of given up. But they want to sell to us, so let them know what we care about.
Great.
So the name of the organization is Campaign for Family Farmers and the Environment, but the easy-to-remember website is Fight Factory Farms, all one word with an S at the end, .org.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Harriet. It's always fun to talk
with
you.
Okay, enjoy your omelets.
Yes, treasure every egg. Yeah. So this has been our show on eggs on Who's in the Kitchen. I'm Philothea Beeson, and I've been talking with Harriet Bihar from Rolling Ground, Wisconsin. And you can tell she's just a trove of a lot of information. We are getting older, and you know what? Experience counts for something. We have had experience in a lot of these different areas and can see how everything is connected.
Egg experience.
So Thanks for tuning in to Who's in the Kitchen. We are on every Saturday at noon, and the last Saturday of the month, we have a show called Digging Deep, which we did today on agriculture, but we will have a Digging Deep at the end of this month. So if you like this show, you can listen live, or you can also go to the archives and find subjects that interest you in about food and farming. So thanks for being on my show, Harriet.
You're welcome.
And we'll talk to you again next week.